everyone, and welcome to the Cabot Cove Gazette, Jessica Fletcher's favorite Murder, She Wrote podcast and ours too. I'm your host, Bridget Keys, coming to you live from my parents' basement like it's 1996. No, for real, this week I'm on vacation and I actually am staying in my parents' basement. And since it's the holiday season, I thought I'd do a special rebroadcast of our episode from January 29th of this year, when my former co-host TJ and I read the Murder, She Wrote novel, A Little Yuletide Murder, and shared our thoughts about the book. I hope you've all read it before listening today, and I hope you enjoy this special rebroadcast. We plan to be back next week with a brand new episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cabot Cove Gazette, the world's best Murder, She Wrote podcast. I am your co-host, TJ West, the third.
I'm Bridget Keys, the first.
And we are very happy to be coming to you this week with a very special episode where we'll be talking about one of the novelized versions of Murder, She Wrote, entitled A Little Yuletide Murder, which is marketed as being written by Jessica Fletcher and Donald Bain. So, Bridget, what is this novel about?
Okay, so our brief summary is that as Cabot Cove is preparing for its annual Christmas festival, the guy who usually plays Santa Claus is found dead, and it is suspected that his cantankerous, disagreeable neighbor murdered him, perhaps over land and money. But it turns out that these families are much more deeply entwined, and the murder had to do with debt and someone's farm getting taken away from them. But also there's a story where their kids were together as children and they got pregnant. And then it turns out the guy who plays Santa Claus is actually a really horrible guy, even though we thought he was the nice one. And the guy we thought was horrible is actually not horrible. And Cabot Cove is completely upset, but everything ends at a happy ending on Christmas Eve.
That's a very good description of exactly what happens. So let's talk about the murder plot first, since ostensibly that is what this book is about, and whether it works and whether it doesn't. And then we can sort of use that to segue into the larger reception of the novel.
So, I mean, I think in some ways the murder is fine. You know, this guy is found dead. Mort goes out to the farm and looks around and doesn't really see any clues except later there's one boot print found. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting clue because we're sort of casually told that the angry guy, his wife, has large feet. You know, we're just sort of casually told that. And so actually that boot print becomes like this really significant clue that if you're not paying attention, you're not thinking it through, kind of like, whoa, that's how that's connected. Mm-hmm. The wife's footprint, she's the one who killed Rory, not her husband. And I thought that worked out really well. I also thought we had an interesting pool of suspects. So Rory is our Santa Claus guy who's really nice. But when they go to the house to, like, talk to the family, his wife is really weird. Like, I don't know if we're supposed to believe she's in shock or she's just an awkward person. Right. She's, like, unfeeling and kind of reticent. And then the son, like, doesn't seem to care that his dad is dead. And he's, like, a total punk.
A punk, which is, I think, a very apt description given the time period. He is the sort of quintessential punk.
I mean, they even talk about him wearing like Doc Martens, right? It's like military boots, you know. So I think he's definitely like courting that punk aesthetic. He likes cars and loud music.
Right.
And then we have, you know, the angry guy,
Jake Sherman,
who seems like the logical suspect, right? Because he's angry all the time and he has a shotgun and he carries it around.
And he's mean to everybody in town.
Yeah. So it seems like, and then Robert, the son, says he heard the two of them arguing. So it seems like he would be the one to do it. So anyway, I think we have like an interesting pool of suspects in that sense. But I guess what I never was satisfied with was like, because Rory's family is so weird, I never really felt like we got an explanation as to why, unless our explanation is just that, they only seem weird if you think Rory was really nice and they all got along. Yes. And if you know that Rory was actually this like monster, then it makes sense. But Rory's monstrousness, his monstrosity, I guess had to do with like being involved in these land deals where they would find farmers who were in debt and give them loans to get out of debt, but the collateral for the loan was the farm itself.
Right.
And so, of course, people can't pay back debts with huge interest, and so they'd lose their farm. So, yeah, that's like kind of a shady, awful thing to do to people, especially like your own neighbors. And
right. Especially in a small town like Cabot Cove, where so many people were, you know, where there's a sort of rural aesthetic built into it.
Yeah, and they all like grew up knowing each other and stuff.
Yeah.
But we didn't ever heard that he was like monstrous in any other way, like especially like in terms of his relationships to his family. So I guess I was just left with this question mark about like they did so much work setting up that Robert, the son, was so mm-hmm. bad. But like,
right.
why? And like, where are we going with that? I guess was my question.
Right. And I wonder if part of this has to do with it being like the way that this book is structured as opposed to like an episode of the show. Because typically an episode of the show will at least get to know the victim a little bit before they die. Like there's enough revelation about who they are as a person to give us an understanding of them as a character. But I agree with you. Like by the time we get to Rory, he's already dead. Like there's no real development and we don't really get to know anything about Rory. So he's just kind of like this blank slate.
Well, I mean, we know that he played Santa Claus and he liked him and the whole town loved him. And
right. But there's a difference between being told that versus mm-hmm. being shown that. Like mm-hmm. in a typical Murder episode, it would show us that. This is describing something that we don't see as readers. And I think that that's somewhat to the book's detriment.
Well, so do you want to dive into talking about the difference between the book and an episode then?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that may be a fruitful...
It seems like it's kind of hard to talk about the murder plot without also talking about the fact that it's literature and not a TV episode.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I observed was the way that clues were handled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Murder, She Wrote as a TV show often doesn't give us all the pieces that we need to put the murder together. There's often things that we're not told, which is very frustrating to me because I like to try to solve along with the episode.
I mean, yeah, because both of us are Agatha Christie fans, and there's generally speaking in an Agatha Christie novel enough clues for us to the reader to figure it out with the character, whether it's Poirot or Marple or whoever. And the novel, as in A Yuletide Murder, sort of is caught in that liminal space between the expectations we have as readers, as not because most people who are mystery fans expect to be able to to figure it out themselves, versus Murder, She Wrote, where that's not, as you say, the typical pattern. And I feel like it is kind of trying to do two kind of incommensurate things that ultimately it can't really succeed in doing.
Mm-hmm. That was my sense too, because I think you often note, when I get frustrated with the show, you often note that, like, well, it just expects us to get swept along mm-hmm. with the narrative. And so, you know, if you're not stopping and trying to piece the clues together, that's fine because it's 45 minutes and you don't really have time to do that. And it'll just tell you, you know, who the murderer was at the end. Like, you don't have right. to do the deductive work if you don't want to. But the thing about a novel is, like, we have all this page space to fill up. And so I expect much more introspection about Jessica. I expect much more thought process as to how they're investigating and to what the clues are. And I really felt like that didn't work. And I thought that process works much better in TV. Mm-hmm. I know there are definitely mystery novels that are like this, where it's a surprise for the reader. But I definitely prefer the ones that let me try to work alongside it.
Speaking of the murder plot, I was struck by the revelation, like the moment when we're in the home of this family, and it kind of like comes out of nowhere, like the Mary, who's the wife, just like, I did it, I don't care. Like he was being a total asshole and calling my daughter a slut and all this other stuff. I mean, because normally Jessica's the one who...
Well, Jessica said she did figure it out because she had these papers from an attorney.
Right.
That presumably told the deals about the loan and the fact that the farm was being taken away by Rory.
I guess it just doesn't have the usual, like, confrontation that we have in Murder, She Wrote. And that's a key part of Murder,
yeah.
She Wrote. Like, that's as it is in that kind of detective tradition. It's, like, traditional for the detective to be like, I've got you. And we don't, like, it doesn't really land.
And you know what else we have in the episode that stood out to me that we don't have here is the aha music.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's our signal in an episode, that da 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 da. And she's like, she knows who did it. Now she just has to prove it or get them to entrap themselves. And in this, it was like, she's at the house. She's talking to Jill, the daughter, who she's very close to. She helped Jill get a scholarship to college. And Jill seems very upset. So Jessica agrees to go out there late at night to talk to her. And then Mary starts confessing. And Jess is like, yeah, I know. I know you did it. And like, well, when exactly did you know? We never knew when you knew.
I feel like that's the problem for me with the murder plot, is that Jessica feels like a bystander more than an investigator.
Mm.
And I feel like that's a real problem, like, mm-hmm. if you're going to be having a story about Jessica Fletcher.
Well, she, I think, wants to be a bystander in this. I mean, there are several times where people ask her to do things or be involved, and she says, that's not my place.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. It felt like a very different Jessica than the one we get right. in TV, who's like, it doesn't matter if it's not her place. Girl is butting in.
And it's interesting to me that the person they choose to have try to interview her is from Fox News, of all places. I was like, okay, that's an interesting choice. I found that the kind of the glimpses of Cabot Cove that we get were nice and cute, but I just felt like the murder part of this did not feel very Murder, She Wrote-y to me, to adjectivize Murder, She Wrote. Like, it just didn't feel like what I would have expected a typical Murder, She Wrote episode to feel like, even in a novel form.
Mm. I think it could have been. I think it just wasn't written in a way that felt like it. Like, I think the actual, like, what happened, who killed whom and why, and what are the red herrings, like, I think all of that could have easily fit into a TV episode, but it just wasn't told to us in a way that felt familiar to the series.
Right. And of course, there's the constant back and forth of Jake Sherman being arrested. Like, he's arrested, but then released, but then arrested, and then the town doesn't like him, so they want him to get, like, basically, you know, they're doing trial, judge, and jury on their own. Which, you know, that feels very true to Murder, She Wrote. Mm-hmm. But, again, where's the investigation? Like, it doesn't feel to me like Jessica does much sleuthing as she normally does. I mean, as you say, she gets the papers, but far too often in this novel, she just seems like someone who's just kind of, like, on the sidelines.
A bystander.
Yeah.
Or coincidentally there.
Yeah, which is more.
She only knows stuff because Mort happened to run into her and tell her stuff.
Right.
She didn't seem very curious to investigate, I guess. And that to me did not ring true to her character at all.
And stylistically, I wonder if that has to do with the first person point of view of this book. Like, that was one of the first things I was like, ooh, I don't know if I like this. And I'm making it well, very... Well,
Jessica Fletcher wrote the story, so of course it's in Jessica Fletcher's...
I know, but know, I'm... Yeah, person. I know, but it's just like, I'm doing... For our listeners, I'm doing this very twisted face, like, ooh. Like, I'm not really, like... Because I just don't know that I need to be in Jessica Fletcher's head. Like, I just don't...
You know what face you just did? This is a total non sequitur, but you just did the face that Rose Nyland makes when she finds out that Jean is a lesbian.
Or when she finds out that her, like, when Rebecca's being artificially inseminated.
Yes! A very Golden Girls non sequitur. Anyway.
Yep. But I was just, like, I don't need to be in a first person point of view for J.B. Fletcher. Like,
so, yeah, I mean, the question is first-person point of view, right? So when you use I, and it's like the character of themselves talking to us, I mean, the question is, does it allow us to have a more intimate knowledge of Jessica than we get on screen? And we get to see her privately. We get to see her when there's nothing happening and she's just making breakfast and stuff that ostensibly we wouldn't see in a TV episode. And so for you, it's interesting that you feel like you actually didn't get a deeper, more intimate knowledge of her.
Right.
Even though she's telling you her story herself.
Yes. I mean, well, let me rephrase that. I don't want that she wrote. Or of J.B. Fletcher. Like, you know, even in a novel, say like Poirot or a Marple novel, with some exceptions, they're not usually first person. And even when they are, they're... first person's looking at the detective. Like, we don't get first person from either Marple or Poirot.
Yeah, like sort of the Watson approach.
Yes, and I personally like that. I don't need... Because, I mean, it would be different if I felt like this contributed to the pleasure of the J.B. Fletcher, but it just didn't for me. Like, I just... It didn't... First of all, it didn't feel like Jessica Fletcher. Like, it felt like someone who happened to be named Jessica Fletcher, but this did not feel like the J.B. Fletcher that we know in the show. But I don't know that it ever could, just because I think that she's such an iconic presence and is so inimitably portrayed by Lansbury that I don't think a novelization, no matter how good it might otherwise be, could ever capture that.
I had a slightly different interpretation than you. So, you know, I'm always poking holes in TV and you're always saying that you're a credulous viewer.
I am a credulous, except when I'm not.
So I had the experience of being a very credulous reader, and I took it on faith that this is who Jessica is, right? Mm. And so what that left me with was a sense of, oh, I don't like Jessica as much as I thought I did. If this is who she really is, I just don't quite like her as much as I thought. So first of all, she just didn't seem as curious as I thought she would be. She didn't always seem that empathetic. And one of the things that I love about Jessica is that she always seems so empathetic to people's circumstances. And here she just kind of, she kept saying like, this doesn't concern me. Or, you know, Mary is like, can you come and talk to the sheriff with me? And she's like, no.
That's not my place.
And then she finally breaks down and does it, but she kind of doesn't really want to.
Yeah.
And when I guess I just wanted a Jessica who was like, well, of course, it's going to be so hard for you to tell the sheriff you lied to him. Of course I'll come. Like, that's the Jessica I love.
Right. I mean, there's also the moment with Jill where that Jill is the daughter of Jake and Mary, who are the poor farmers that are the suspects. And Jill had an affair with the rich farmer's son and got pregnant in high school. And so went to this place in Portland. Where Salem. She could have had Salem, sorry. I knew as soon as I said it was wrong. And, you know, Jessica acts very, like, condemnatory that she may have had an abortion. Like, and that part of the novel just kind of felt like ick for me. Because the whole way that whole plot was handled, the way that Jessica's perception of Jill and her, you know, the pregnancy and all that stuff. Again, to your point, that doesn't feel like the Jessica that I know from the TV show. Like, it feels like a separate and character, which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that per se, but that's not Jessica Fletcher, you know?
Well, I don't know that I don't know. I think the issue is we don't know. I mean, the Jessica in this book, especially in those moments, was very principled. She was very principled toward pro-life. And that could be who Jessica is, but we don't know from the TV episodes. I mean, we've had abortion mentioned a couple of times in episodes, and she's always, again, I think her reigning quality is empathy over her own principles, you know?
Right.
And so it's like, well, that's your business, and I'm just here to support you.
But as you say, like, this novel doesn't even give her empathy. Like, she's not particularly empathetic either.
So we didn't get her, should we get her saying things like, when Jill reveals that, like, actually she didn't have the abortion, she did have the baby and gave it up for adoption, Jessica's like, oh, thank God. Like, is that really how Jessica feels? Like, I didn't know that.
Right. Again, I'm going to push back and say that I don't actually, I view these as two separate characters. Like, there's the literary J.B. Fletcher, who's the, you know, if I may be blunt and a little cynical, is the cash grab Jessica. And then there's J.B., the beloved J.B. Fletcher of small screen fame. And I think that for me, as a reader and as a fan, those are two very different entities, and I think about them very differently.
Well, there were definitely some straight-up inconsistencies. For at several points, she mentions that Cabot – first of all, why are they called Cabot Covites? Shouldn't they be Cabot Covers? Wouldn't that be the logical name for them?
I was going to say Cabot Covians, but
– no, Cabot Covers would be the logical name. Anyway, it's mentioned several times that they – are an early to bed, early to rise kind of people. And while it's true that Jessica is early to rise, we see that frequently in the series, we also know from the series that she's a night owl.
Mm-hmm.
We see her up until 1 a.m. frequently. So I was like, nope, that's just actually not Jessica at all. Like, that's just incorrect, right? And then, you know, what I thought was interesting was there's this whole thing with Mary where Mary keeps calling her Mrs. Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
And Jessica is like, look, we've done a lot of committee work together. We've known each other for years. You can call me Jessica. And Mary really struggles with it. And finally, Mary reveals, like, look, you're above me, basically. You're rich. You're famous. You have money. You're well-loved. I'm just a nobody with no money. So you're my superior. And so I should call you by an honorific. And Jessica is, like, very insistent that she is not Mary's superior. Now, that does feel in keeping with Jessica's character. And, in fact, that is in the series Bible, that Jessica does not think she is anyone's superior. Yes. And she gets along equally with people of all social classes. Like, that was written into the series Bible. But I thought her endless insistence on being called Jessica felt a little untrue to the character, because there are lots of people who refer to her as Mrs. Fletcher.
Mm.
And Jessica isn't an overly familiar person. That's also written into the series Bible. She is a person for whom, like, a sort of arm's length respectability is more important than a sort of American over-familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that felt a little weird to me, too.
Yep. And, I mean, speaking of Cabot Covers, if you will, like
– Cabot Covites.
I want to preface this by saying I did not hate this. I thought it was enjoyable. I breezed through it. I thought it was a very fun read. But it felt to me at some points very stale. Like, this Cabot Cove doesn't feel like the warm and charming and lovely place that I'm familiar with from the show. And that to me seems like a failing that the novel, at least to me, and again, you may feel differently, but I'm just saying that, like, for me, it felt a little both stale, antiseptic, and sometimes just a little mean-spirited. Like, this wasn't like the warm and but sometimes crusty New Englander town that I'm familiar with from the show.
What made you feel that they were a little mean-spirited?
I don't know. Like, just some of the, like, as you say, like, the dynamic between Mary and Jake and Jessica feels very strained. Like, the way that the whole town turns against Jake. I mean, I know that that's something that happens in the show, too. But because there aren't as many scenes of, like, just genuine, like, warmth. I don't know. The whole town just didn't feel as authentically Cabot Covean as I expected it to.
I had a similar take that it didn't feel like Cabot Cove, but I guess I was a more credulous reader than you. I thought, well, okay, this book was written in 98, so maybe since the time the show went off the air, like, the town has clearly grown in this book. It's a much bigger mm-hmm. Cabot Cove than we ever see in the TV series. And in fact, we're told that it's expanded and up the street are, like, chain restaurants and strip malls. So I was like, oh, Cabot Cove must be a town of, like, 30,000 or something by now.
Ugh, who wants McDonald's in Cabot Cove?
Well, it's up the street at least. You have to drive up the highway. But so, you know, that felt really different. And then there, Seth and Jessica go to, they go out to eat a lot in this book. There's a lot of page space spent talking about food.
And not even particularly, but it's not well articulated. Like, it's not, I didn't feel like I needed to run out and get whatever was being served.
Well, that's because all they're ever eating is, like, clams, barf. But anyway, my point is they go to tons of different restaurants and bakeries. So it's like, where did all these places come from? Like, so I felt like, oh, the town has greatly expanded. So if it doesn't feel like my Cabot Cove, maybe that's because in the time since the series went off the air, you know, new people moved into town, new restaurants popped up. And so I just don't know them yet.
I guess the biggest question facing this novel and, I, you know, the entire 40-book series that's ongoing of novelizations of Murder, She Wrote is, what do we want from a novelization of Murder, She Wrote? Like, as opposed, like, why are you giving me that look?
I don't know. It's like this just took, like, a lit studies PhD, like, turn all of a sudden. What do we want from a novelization?
Well, I think it's a legitimate question. Like, you could take the boy out of the academy, but you can't take the academy out of the boy. That's.
Well, I think people want more Jessica, right? We want more Jessica, and we can't get it from Angela Lansbury on screen. So this is the best we can do, right?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. But I would need to, like, do a little more primary examination, because it does seem like people love these novels. Mm-hmm. So I would be curious to see, like, what people are getting out of them. Because, like, what am I missing? Because I don't want to put all of this on the novel. Like, what am I not getting out of it? Is it just because I'm not as credulous in this case as you are? Is it because I'm just so indebted to the show and the particularities of the show mm-hmm. that I can't, like, quite bring myself to like this novel? I want to be clear. I went in wanting to like it. And there were moments when I genuinely enjoyed myself. But as a whole, I was just kind of left a little bit cold.
Well, that's a shame. This was, if you guys remember, this was actually a Christmas gift that I sent TJ last year so that we could do this special episode as, like, a surprise. So it's a little bit, it's sad that we weren't, like, madly in love with this book. But
I mean, I would read another one. Like, I wouldn't, like, unequivocally.
Yeah, I think I would too. I mean, I read the whole thing in two sittings.
Yeah, me too.
So it was, you know, I devoured it. It was, I guess, in that sense, it was a page turner. Like, I read it really quickly and I was engrossed in it while I was reading it. But I wasn't, like, as in love with it as I was the TV show.
See, this is, I mean, to me, I'm going to put it this way. And I'm going to try not to sound pretentious, but it's what I'm going to say is going to sound very condescending.
You can't help but sound pretentious, darling, because you are pretentious.
It is true. I grew up poor, so we always learn how to ape the mannerisms of our betters. But anyway.
It's true, because you are far more pretentious than me.
Exactly. Anyway, so I found the prose of this very workmanlike. Like, it's very, like, it's, you know, it's not plotting. It's just, it's serviceable. Like, it's not, and I find that the writing in Murder, She Wrote also is serviceable, because it's a network show, so it's not, like, you know, it's not prestige drama, necessarily.
It's middlebrow.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the difference between enjoying something that's middlebrow television and a middlebrow novel. Because, like, at least in a middlebrow television, you still have enough dynamism of the characters, like, and the people playing them, and the star, like, glamour attached to them, or the charisma, that just you don't have in a novel. Like, you just don't. It's just not part of the novel experience. And so, like, I tend to be a very forgiving reader, too. I mean, for God's sake, I read fantasy, the only other, one of the other more maligned genres. And so, like, I just found the prose, you know, and the way, and the characterization, like, fine, but there's, it lacked the essential magic of Murder, She Wrote, which can only come from the people playing the characters.
From actors, yeah.
So I think that's what I'm, like I said, that's just my take on it.
There were a couple of moments where I felt like Bane had really captured Murder, She Wrote dialogue.
Yes, that is true.
There were a couple of moments, but then there were other points where I was like, this dialogue works in TV where you need to explain things to me. But because I just had a paragraph of exposition before, I already know this, so I don't need Jessica to say it to Seth.
Yep.
You know, it was like sort of awkward in that way. And then another thing I noticed was in the episodes, Mort, although he's lived in Cabot Cove for a long time by the end of the series, he never adopts Cabot Cove speech or mm-hmm. accent or dialect or anything like that. Like, he remains an outsider in that sense in his speech. And this Mort is, his voice is quite like Seth's. Like, he says Aya and stuff.
Yep.
And, like, Mort never says that. Mm-hmm. And probably that's more, it's more believable that he would, right? Because, like, you move somewhere, you start talking like the people there.
Uh-huh.
But that bothered me just because I was like, Mort never says Aya. Like, that's not. And then at one point, Seth said, we should hook up later. And I was like, Seth Hazlitt does not say hook up, you guys. Like, he wasn't talking about a sexual encounter, right? He just meant, like, we should meet. But, like, he does not use that language. And at one point, Jessica said, what's up? But J.B. Fletcher does not ask people what's up. Come on.
No. It's like, how are you doing? Like, what's good? Like, yeah, I agree. I was just like, yeah, I'm not buying that.
Okay, let's talk about the big thing, though. Because Santa Claus is dead, at the end of the episode, look at me, I'm such a TV scholar. At the end of the book, we have the Christmas festival. We need somebody to play Santa Claus. So they decide in this sort of feminist gesture that Jessica is going to play Santa Claus by wearing a beard and putting pillows around herself to be fat.
Yep. That is a thing one could do.
I don't believe that for a second. No. I think Seth would have been Santa Claus. I think if they had insisted that Jessica be involved, I think Jessica would have insisted to be Mrs. Claus.
Right.
Which is believable because Lansbury actually played Mrs. Santa Claus in a TV movie.
As we know, because we did an episode on it.
Yeah, you should all go listen to that episode. But I don't believe that Jessica would be talked into being Santa Claus. I just cannot see her doing that.
Nope, I couldn't either. I was just like, this is taking me out of this novel. I just cannot. the part where they're reading the stories just felt trite. It didn't feel charming in the way that I would have expected from, like, if that had been on screen, I might have been a little more convinced, but it just felt very trite to me in a not good way.
So he's talking about this moment at the Christmas festival where Jessica and Seth are reading stories to children, and we're told that behind them, the illustrations from the books are being projected.
Right, which I'm also, I had all sorts of questions about, like, how exactly this projection
about
system is.
About copyright violation or what?
Well, just this projection system and, like, what?
It's an overhead projector.
I know, but does it have to be on transparencies to be able to project?
Yeah, they took them to the copy shop and made transparencies.
Okay. Seems like a lot of work for a Christmas festival.
We had that technology.
I know. I was also in the high school in the 90s.
Overheads were amazing. I think we should bring them back,
that's
frankly.
True. I do, too. I 100% think we should bring overheads back.
They were way easier than this dot cam tech stuff we have today.
Yes. Yeah. 1,000.
Yeah.
1,000 times. Plus, you could watch teachers write on the transparencies. It was really cool, but anyway.
Oh, my God. My geometry teacher would, like, that was all she did. She never wrote on the chalkboard, and we'd go through, like, 25 transparencies in the course of one geometry class. It was the best class I ever took in my life. Yep. That's not true. I'm sorry, Madame Marshall. I loved your French classes. Anyway, I thought that that moment was supposed to be like our little touching moment of seeing Jessica and Seth their Jessica and Seth thing, you know, where they're basically a couple. But I think you're right that, especially because we're told that there's like projected imagery and stuff, and then we're told they're saying things back and forth, like they're taking turns reading paragraphs and whatnot. It probably would work much better in visual media.
Yeah.
Like on screen. It would be cuter, yeah.
Totally.
But I'm sad that you didn't think it was heartwarming in any way.
Not really. I just found it trite and cheap. Much as I found this novel to be trite and cheap, but that's what it's supposed to be. Like, that's the thing. It's like,
I think you might be expecting too much of this, you know?
I was expecting.
It's a mass market paperback.
Yeah. You're probably right. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, I've been very upfront about that. Like, I'm not.
But yeah, I mean, to that same point, I say that, but like to that same point, like if it were a mass market paperback with different characters' names, it would have been great. But yeah. It's just like, that's not who I want Jessica to be.
Mm-mm. Yep, I 100%, 110% agree with you.
She's a little bit fussy, which, you know, Lansbury was too. So maybe it's authentic in that sense. But I also just want to.
Yes, but that's not Jessica Fletcher.
I also just want to pretend like Lansbury wasn't fussy. So, you know.
Exactly. That's why they're stars. We project ourselves onto them. That's why we have stars.
Yeah.
Among other reasons.
Yeah. I think what it gets at to you is over and over again, when I talk to Murder, She Wrote fans, what they love about Murder, She Wrote is that sort of grandmotherly, friendly, charming-ness of Jessica, right? And mm-hmm. There's definitely evidence in Lansbury's files that she tried to resist that a little bit.
As one would.
And so I think this book is kind of picking up on that, yeah. Right? And it's like, but no, that's not the Jessica we want. We want the cuddly Jessica. Right. We don't want the, like, Maggie Smith Jessica.
Exactly. Right. This is not the Dowager Duchess of Downton Abbey. This is J.B. Fletcher, damn it.
What is a weekend?
Exactly. Oh,
well,
Lord.
Cabot Cove. The Cabot Cove of the future.
Yep.
They probably built the waterfront up, too. We probably just didn't see that. I bet you there's condos on the waterfront by now,
I guess we'll
too.
Find out, because this book series is ongoing. There's going to be one in 2023, so I guess we'll have to pick it up and see what happens.
Jessica will be involved in a murder plot over Zoom.
Hard pass. All right. Well, thank you all, as always, for joining us here at the Cabot Cove Gazette. I'm your co-host, TJ West III.
I'm Bridget Keys, and that is Linus the Cat,
who is snuggly up beside her. So we will be right back with you next week.
The Cabot Cove Gazette's theme song is Reaching the Sky by Alexander Nakarada, used under Creative Commons license. You can find us on social media. We're Cabot Cove Gazette on Facebook and @Cove Gazette on Instagram and Twitter.